last year. It was me who took you round the school. The revelation blossoms as rain begins to fall. I remember exactly now. Michael Holden had shown me attentively round Truham when I was deciding whether to go there for sixth form. He'd asked me what A-levels I wanted to do, and whether I liked Higgs very much, and whether I had any hobbies, and whether I cared much about sports. In fact, everything he'd said had been utterly unremarkable. But it's impossible. But you were so normal. He shrugs and smiles, and the raindrops on his face almost make him seem as if he's crying. There's a time and a place for being normal. For most people, normal is a default. But for some, like you and me, normal is something we have to bring out, like putting on a suit for a posh dinner. What, now he's being profound? Why did you need to tell me this? Why did you need to track me down? Why was it that important? He shrugs again. It wasn't, I guess, but I wanted you to know. And when I want to do something, I usually do it. I stare at him. Nick and Charlie were right. He's absolutely insane. He holds up a hand and sends me a slight wave. See you soon, Tory Spring. And then he wanders away. I'm left standing under the broken lamppost in my black jumper and the rain, wondering whether I'm feeling anything yet, and realizing that it's all very funny, because it's all very true. Chapter 6. I head inside, go into the dining room, and say hello to my family. They're still at dinner, as usual. Well, except Oliver. Since dinner's kind of a 2 to 3 hour job in our house, Oliver's always allowed to leave the table once he's done, and I can hear him playing Mario Kart in the living room. I decide to join him. If I could swap bodies with someone for a day, I would choose Oliver. Tory! As soon as I enter, he rolls over on the futon and stretches his arm toward me like a zombie rising out of the grave. He must have got yogurt all down his school jumper today. And he has paint on his face. I can't win on Rainbow Road. Help me. I sigh, sit down on the futon next to him, and pick up the spare Wii remote. This track is impossible, bro.
No, he whines. Nothing's impossible. I think the game's cheating.
The game can't cheat.
It is. It's cheating on purpose.
It's not cheating you, Ollie.
Charlie can win. It just doesn't like me.
I produce a large and exaggerated gasp, springing up from the futon. Are you suggesting that Charlie is better at Mario Kart than moi? I start to shake my head. Nope, nuh-uh. I'm the Mario Kart Empress. Oliver laughs, his fluffy hair waving around atop his head. I fall back onto the futon, lift him up, and sit him on my lap. All right, I say. Rainbow Road is going down. I don't keep track of how long we're playing, but it must be quite a while, because when Mum comes in, she's pretty irritated. And that's extreme for her. She's a very emotionless person. Tory, says Mum. Oliver should have been in bed an hour ago. Oliver doesn't seem to hear her. I glance up from the race. That's not really my job, I say. Mum looks at me expressionless. Oliver, it's bedtime, she says, still looking at me. Oliver quits the game and trots off, high-fiving me on the way. Even when he's gone, Mum doesn't stop looking at me. Do you have something to say? I ask. Apparently, she doesn't. She turns around and leaves. I get in a quick round of Luigi circuit before heading to my own room. I don't think my mum likes me very much. That doesn't really matter, because I don't really like her either. I put the radio on and blog until the early hours. The radio is playing all this dubstep crap, but I've got it on quietly, so I don't care too much. I can't be bothered to leave my bed, except to make at least 5 trips downstairs for more diet lemonade. I check the solitaire blog, but there's nothing new. So I spend ages scrolling down all my favourite blogs, reblogging screen caps of Donnie Darko and Submarine and The Simpsons taken out of context. I write a couple of whiny posts about I don't even know what, and I almost change my display picture but can't find anything where I look normal. So I fiddle around with my blog theme's HTML for a bit to see if I can remove the gaps between each post. I stalk Michael's Facebook, but he seems to use it even less than I do. I watch a bit of QI, but I don't really find it interesting or funny anymore. So instead, I watch Little Miss Sunshine, which I didn't finish yesterday. I never seem to be able to finish watching a film on the same day I started it, because I can't bear the thought of the film ending. After a while, I put my laptop by my side and lie down. I think about all the other people who were at the restaurant, who are probably now drunk and getting off with each other on Lauren's parents' sofas. At some point, I fall asleep, but I can hear all these creaky noises coming from outside, and something in my brain decides that there is definitely some kind of giant and/or demon stomping around in the road. So I get up and close the window just to make sure that whatever it is cannot get inside. When I get back into bed, every single thing that you could possibly think about in one day decides to come to me all at once, and suddenly there's a small lightning storm inside my head. I think about solitaire, and then I think about Michael Holden and why he said we should be friends, and what he was really like when he was at Truam. Then I remember Lucas and how embarrassed he was, and I wonder why he spent all that effort trying to find me. Then I remember his Hawaiian shirt, which still enormously irritates me because I hate to think that he's become some indie band wannabe. So I open my eyes and wander around the internet to take my mind off it all, and once I feel relatively okay again, I fall asleep with the glare of my blog homepage warming my face and the hum of my laptop soothing my mind like crickets at a campsite. Chapter 7. We didn't expect anything more from solitaire. We thought the one prank would be the end of it. We were quite a way off. On Wednesday, all the clocks magically vanished and were replaced by pieces of paper reading Tempus Fugit. It was funny at first, but after a few hours, when you're midway through a lesson and you can't check your phone and you have no way of finding out what the time is, well, it pretty much makes you want to scratch out your eyeballs. On the same day, there was hysteria in whole school assembly when the loudspeaker started playing Justin Timberlake's Sexy Back as Kent walked up the hall stage stairs and the word swag appeared on the projector screen. On Thursday, we turned up to find that 2 cats had been let loose within the school. Apparently, the caretakers managed to get one of them out, but the other cat, an underfed ginger thing with massive eyes, evaded capture all day, strolling in and out of lessons and through corridors. I quite like cats, and I saw it for the first time at lunch in the cafeteria. I almost felt like I'd made a new friend, the way it hopped onto a chair and sat with our lot, as if it wanted to join our gossip and offer its views about celebrity Twitter rows and the current political climate. I noted to myself that I should probably start collecting cats, seeing as they are very likely to be my sole companions in 10 years' time. My spirit animal would so be a cat, said Becky. Lauren nodded. Cats are Britain's national animal. My boyfriend has a cat called Steve, said Evelyn. Isn't that an excellent name for a cat, Steve? Becky rolled her eyes. Evelyn, dude, when are you going to tell us who your boyfriend is? But Evelyn just smiled and pretended to be embarrassed. I peered into the dark eyes of the cat. It met my gaze, thoughtfully. Do you remember when some lady got caught on camera dumping a cat into a brown bin and it made national news? Every single prank was photographed and displayed on the Solitaire blog. Anyway, today is Friday. People are beginning to find it less funny, as Madonna's Material Girl has been stuck on repeat all day over the loudspeaker. I used to have a small obsession with this song, and I am coming extremely close to slitting my wrists with my scissors, and it's only 10:45 a.m. I'm still not quite sure how Solitaire is managing to do all this, as Zelda and her prefects have been patrolling the school ever since Wednesday's clock fiasco. I'm sitting at a table playing chess on my phone during a free period, iPod blasting some Radiohead song into my ears to block out the vomit-inducing music. The common room has only a scattering of people, mostly year 13s revising for January retakes. Miss Strasser is overseeing the room because, during lesson times, the common room is reserved for people revising, and silence is mandatory. This is why I like this room. Except today. Strasser's hung a spare school jumper over the loudspeaker, but it's not doing much. In the corner of the common room, Becky and Ben are sitting together. They are not doing any work, and they are both smiling. Becky keeps tucking her hair behind her ears. Ben takes Becky's hand and starts to draw on it. I look away. So long, Jack. Someone taps me on the shoulder, so suddenly that I have a miniature spasm. I take my headphones out of my ears and swivel around. Lucas stands before me. Every time we passed in the corridor this week, he gave me these weird little waves, or smiles. I don't know, the sort of smiles where you scrunch up your face, and in any other context, people would wonder whether there was something wrong with you. Anyway, right now he has his bag slung over one shoulder, and in his other arm he has a pile of at least 7 books. Hi, he says, just above a whisper. Hi, I say. There is a short pause before I follow up with, do you want to sit here? Embarrassment pours over his face, but he quickly replies, yeah, thanks. He pulls out the chair next to me, dumps his bag and books on the desk, and sits down. I've still got my phone in my hand, and I'm just kind of staring at him. He sticks a hand into his bag and withdraws a Sprite can. He places it in front of me, like a cat would place a half-chewed mouse in front of its owner. I was at the shop at break, he says without looking me in the eye. Is lemonade still your favourite? I look down at the Sprite can, not quite sure what to make of it. I do not point out that Sprite is not real lemonade or diet. Yeah, it is. Thanks. That's, really nice of you. Lucas nods and turns away. I open the Sprite, take a sip, replace my headphones, and return to my game. After only 3 more moves, I have to remove my headphones again. You're playing chess? He asks. I hate questions that need not be asked. Yes. Do you remember chess club? Lucas and I were members of our primary school chess club. We played each other every time and not once could I beat him. I always threw a tantrum whenever I lost. God, I used to be a twat. No, I say. I lie a lot for no reason. No, I don't. He pauses, and for a moment I think he sees through me, but he's too embarrassed to push it. You have a lot of books, I say, as if he wasn't aware of this. He nods, smiling awkwardly. I like to read, and I've just been in the library. I recognize all the titles, but of course I haven't read any of them. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, D.H. Lawrence's Sons and Lovers, John Fowles's The Collector, and Jane Austen's Emma. So, what are you reading now? I ask. The books at least provide a topic of conversation. The Great Gatsby, he says. F. Scott Fitzgerald. What's that about? It's about... He pauses to think. It's about someone who's in love with a dream. I nod as if I understand. I don't. I don't know a single thing about literature, despite studying it for A-level. I pick up Emma. Does this mean you actually like Jane Austen? We're still studying Pride and Prejudice in class. It is soul-destroying, and not in a good way. Do not read it. He tilts his head as if it's a deeply serious question. You sound surprised. I am. It's dreadful. I can barely get past the first chapter. Why is that? It's the literary equivalent of a poorly cast rom-com. Someone gets up and tries to walk past us, so we both have to tuck in our chairs a little. Lucas is looking at me very carefully. I don't like it. You're so different, he says, shaking his head and squinting at me. I may have grown a few inches since I was 11. No, it's... He stops himself. I put down my phone. What? It's what? You're more serious. I don't ever remember not being serious. As far as I'm concerned, I came out of the womb spouting cynicism and wishing for rain. I'm not really sure how to reply. I am possibly the least funny person since Margaret Thatcher. No, but you were always dreaming up all these imaginary games, like our Pokemon battles or the secret base you made out of the cornered-off section of the playground. Would you like to have a Pokemon battle? I fold my arms. Or am I too unimaginative for that? No. He's digging himself into a hole, and it's actually quite funny to watch. I don't know. I raise my eyebrows. Quit while you're ahead. I'm boring now. I'm a lost cause. I instantly wish I just shut up. I always do this thing where I accidentally say self-deprecating stuff that makes other people feel really awkward, especially when it's true. I start to wish I had never offered to let him sit with me. He quickly returns to the work he got out of his bag. Material Girl is still playing over and over. Apparently the janitors are trying to fix it, but at the moment the only solution appears to be cutting the electrics of the entire school, which according to Kent will classify as giving in. He's got that World War II Churchill attitude, old Mr. Kent. I take a quick glance out of the windows behind the computers. I know I should be doing some homework too, but I'd much rather play chess and admire the windy greyness outside. That's my major problem with school. I really don't do anything unless I actually want to do it. And most of the time, I don't want to do anything at all. You've had quite a good first week, I say, my eyes still focused on the sky. Best week of my entire life, he says. Seems like an exaggeration to me, but to each their own. Lucas is such an innocent guy. Awkward and innocent. In fact, he's so awkward that it's almost as if he's putting it on. I know he's probably not, but that's still the way it comes across. I mean, awkward is very in fashion at the moment. It's frustrating. I have experienced my fair share of awkward, and awkward is not cute. Awkward does not make you more attractive, and awkward certainly should not be fashionable. It just makes you look like an idiot. Why did we stop being friends? He asks, not looking at me. I pause. People grow up and move on. That's life. I regret saying this, however true it might be. I see a kind of sadness fizzle into his eyes, but it quickly disappears. Well, he says, and turns to me. We're not grown up yet. He takes out his phone and starts to read something on it. I watch as his face melts into something confusing. The bell that signals the end of break somehow manages to sound over the music, and he puts the phone away and starts to gather his stuff. Got a lesson? I ask, and then realize that this is one of those pointless questions that I hate. History. I'll see you later. He walks several paces before turning, as if he has something else to say. But he just stands there. I give him a strange sort of smile, which he returns, and then goes away. I watch as he meets a boy with a large quiff at the door, and they start up a conversation as they exit the common room. Finally at peace, I return to my music. My iPod has shuffled on to Amy Mann, just one of my many depressing 90s artists that nobody has heard of. I get to wondering where Michael Holden might be. I haven't seen him since Tuesday. I don't have his phone number or anything. Even if I did, it's not like I would text him. I don't text anyone. I don't really do much for the next hour. To tell you the truth, I'm not even sure if I'm supposed to be in a lesson, but I really can't find the will to move. I briefly wonder again who Solitaire might be, but I conclude for the billionth time that I just do not care. I set an alarm on my phone to remind me to take Charlie to therapy tonight because Nick is busy, and then I sit very still with my head on one arm and doze off. I wake up just before the bell goes again. I swear to God I'm a freak. I mean it. One day, I'm going to forget how to wake up. Chapter 8. I'm sprawled on the computer desks in the common room at 8:21 a.m. on Monday, with Becky raving on about how cute Ben Hope was at Lauren's. That was 6 days ago, for God's sake. When someone bellows with extreme resonance from the door. Has anyone seen Tory Spring? I wake from the dead. Oh, Christ. Becky roars my location across the air, and before I have time to hide under the desk, Zelda Okoro is standing in front of me. I flatten my hair, hoping it will shield me from her dictatorial intervention. Zelda wears full makeup to school every day, including lipstick and eyeshadow, and I think she might be certifiably insane. Tori, I'm nominating you for Operation Inconspicuous. It takes several seconds for this information to register. No, you are not, I say. No, no. Yes, you haven't got a say. The deputy heads voted on who they wanted in year 12. What? I slump back onto the desk. What for? Zelda puts her hands on her hips and tilts her head. We're facing a crisis, Tori. She speaks way too fast and in extremely short sentences. I don't like it. Higgs is facing a crisis. A team of 8 prefects just isn't going to cover it. We're upping the stakeout ops team to 15. Operation Inconspicuous is a go. Tomorrow, 0700. I'm sorry, what did you just say? We've come to the conclusion that most of the sabotage must be happening during the early hours, so we're staking out tomorrow morning. 0700, you'd better be there.
I hate you, I say.
Don't blame me, she says. Blame Solitaire. She clip-clops off. Becky, Evelyn, Lauren and Rita are all around me. Lucas, too. I think he's one of our lot now.
Well, you're obviously in the teacher's good books, says Becky. Next thing you know, they'll be making you an actual prefect.
I shoot her a look of severe distress.
Yeah, but if you were a prefect, you could skip the lunch queue, says Lauren. Fast food, man, and you could give Year 7's detentions whenever they're being too cheerful.
What did you even do to make the teachers like you? Asks Becky.
You don't exactly do much.
I shrug at her. She's right. I don't do much at all. Later in the day, I pass Michael in the corridor.
I say pass, but what actually happens is he shouts, Tory, so loudly that I manage to drop my English folder on the floor. He lets out this deafening laugh, his eyes scrunching up behind his glasses, and he actually stops and stands still in the middle of the corridor, causing 3 Year 8s to bump into him. I look at him, pick up my folder, and walk right past. I'm in English now, reading Pride and Prejudice. Now that I have reached chapter 6, I have established that I hate this book with a profound passion. It's boring and cliché, and I constantly feel the need to hold it over a lit match. The women only care about the men, and the men don't seem to care about anything at all. Except Darcy, maybe. He's not so bad. Lucas is the only person I can see who is reading the book properly, with his calm and quiet expression, but every so often he checks his phone. I scroll through a few blogs on my own phone under the desk, but there really isn't anything interesting on there. Becky is in the next seat to me, and she is talking to Ben Hope. Unfortunately, I can't avoid them without moving to a different seat, or leaving the class, or dying. They are playing dots and boxes in Ben's school planner. Becky keeps losing. You're cheating, she exclaims and attempts to grab Ben's pen. Ben laughs a very attractive laugh. They have a small wrestling match over the pen. I try not to throw up or dive under the table from sheer cringe. In the common room at lunch, Becky tells Evelyn all about Ben. At some point, I interrupt their conversation.
What happened to Jack? I ask her.
Jack who? She says.
I blink at her, and she turns back to Evelyn. Chapter 9. Dad gets me to school at 6:55 a.m. the next day. I am in a trance. In the car, he says,
Maybe if you catch them in the act, you'll get a community award.
I don't know what a community award is, but I feel that I'm probably the least likely person in the world to get one. Zelda, her prefects, the nominated helpers, and even old Kent are in the hall, and I'm the only one there who came in school uniform. It's basically nighttime outside. The school heating hasn't started up yet. I praise myself for putting on 2 pairs of tights this morning. Zelda, in leggings and running trainers and an oversized super dry hoodie, takes charge.
Okay, guys, today's the day we're catching them, yeah? Everyone's got a separate area of the school. Patrol that area and call me if you find anything. Nothing's been done to the school since Friday, so there's a chance they won't turn up today. But we're going to do this until we feel that the school is safe, whether we end up catching anyone or not. Meet back in the hall at 8.
Why did I even come here?
The prefects begin to chat among themselves, and Zelda speaks to each person individually before sending them off into the unlit, unheated depths of the school. When she gets to me,
She presents me with a piece of paper and says, "Tori, you're patrolling the IT suites. Here's my number." I nod at her and go to walk off. Tori?
Yeah?
You look a bit...
She doesn't finish her sentence.
It's 7 a.m. She can piss off. I walk away, throwing the piece of paper in a bin as I pass it. I come to a halt upon finding Kent standing ominously by the hall entrance.
Why me? I ask him. But he just raises his eyebrows and smiles at me, so I roll my eyes and walk away. Wandering around the school like this is peculiar. Everything's so still, serene, no air circulation. I'm walking through a freeze frame. The IT suite is in C block, on the second floor. There are 6 computer rooms, C11, C12, C13, C14, C15, and C16. The usual whir of the suite is absent. The computers are all dead. I open up C11, peer inside, and repeat this for C12, C13, and C14, before giving up and taking a seat on a swivel chair inside C14. What does Ken even think he's doing involving me in this? As if I'm going to do any kind of patrolling. I kick the floor and spin. The world hurricanes around me. I don't know how long I do this, but when I stop to read the time, the clock waves in front of my eyes. When it calms down, it reads 7:16 a.m. I wonder for at least the 16th time what I am doing here. It is then that I hear a distant sound of the windows booting up jingle. I get off my chair and step into the corridor. I look one way. I look the other. The corridor dissolves into darkness both ways, but out of the open door of C13 glares a hazy blue glow. I creep down the corridor and go inside. The interactive whiteboard is on, the projector whirring happily, the Windows desktop on display. I stand before the board, staring into it. The desktop wallpaper is a sloped green field beneath a blue sky. The harder I stare, the wider the board seems to spread. Wider and wider, until the fake pixelated world invades my own. The computer that is linked to the screen hums. The door to the room shuts by itself, like I'm in Scooby-Doo. I run and grab the handle, but it's locked. And for a second, I just stare at myself in the door window. Someone's locked me in an IT room, for God's sake. Stepping backward, I see the board change in the blank monitor's reflections. I spin on the spot. The green field has gone. In its place is a blank page of Microsoft Word with the cursor flashing on and off. I try smashing at the keyboard of the computer that's hooked up to the board and wildly swishing the mouse across the table. Nothing happens. I'm starting to sweat. My brain isn't accepting this situation. I come up with 2 possibilities. 1, this is a sick joke by someone I know. 2, solitaire. And that's when the text rolls across the white screenscape. Attention team ops, please refrain from panic and alarm. Pause. What? Solitaire is a friendly neighborhood watch organization dedicated to aiding the adolescent population through targeting the most common cause of teenage anxiety. We are on your side. You should not be afraid of any action we will not take. We hope that you will support Solitaire's future actions and come to feel that school need not be a place of solemnity, stress, and isolation. Someone is trying to deliberately freak the prefects out. As I am not a prefect, I am choosing not to freak out.
I don't know what I feel about this, but it definitely isn't freaked out. We leave you with a video that we hope will enlighten your morning. Solitaire. Patience kills. The page of text remains on screen for several seconds before Windows Media Player pops up in front of it. The cursor zooms to the play button and the video begins. The footage is kind of blurry, but you can make out two figures on a stage, one at a piano, one with a violin in her hands. The violinist holds her instrument up to her chin and raises her bow, and together, the two begin to play. Only after the first 8 bars, and after the camera has zoomed in, do I realize that the musicians can be no more than 8 years old. I don't know what the piece of music is. It doesn't matter. Because sometimes I hear a piece of music and I can't do anything but sit there. Sometimes in the morning the radio turns on and a song is playing. And it's so beautiful that I just have to lie there until it's over. Sometimes I'm watching a film and it's not even a sad scene, but the music is so sad that I can't help but cry. This is one of those times. Eventually, the video ends, and I just stand there. I guess Solitaire thinks it's being intellectual and deep, making us watch that video and writing with such eloquence, like people who think that they're hilarious for using the word thus in school essays. It half makes me laugh and half makes me want to shoot them. The fact remains that C-13's door is still locked and I'm still trapped here. I want to cry out, but I don't. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I threw away Zelda's number like the idiot I am. I don't know anyone else here. I can't call Becky. She wouldn't come here. Dad's at work. Mum's in her PJs. Charlie won't get to school for another 45 minutes. There is only one person who would help me. There is only one person who is going to believe me. I pull my phone out of my blazer pocket. Hello? Before you say anything else, I have a question.
Tori, oh my God, you actually called me.
Are you a real person? I've been considering the possibility that Michael Holden is a figment of my imagination. This is probably because I fail to understand how someone with a personality like his could survive in this shitty world, and also because I fail to understand how someone with a personality like his would take any interest in a misanthropic, pessimistic asshole like myself. I found his number posted in my locker yesterday lunchtime. It was written on one of those solitaire pink post-its with an arrow drawn on it, except now he'd added his phone number and a smiley face. I knew that it was Michael. Who else would it be? There is a long pause before he says, I promise, I swear, that I am a completely real person, here. On the earth, living and breathing. He waits for me to say something, and when I don't, he continues. And I can understand why you would ask me that, so I'm not offended or anything. Okay. Thanks for, clearing that up. I proceed to explain in the most nonchalant way I can muster that I am locked in an IT classroom. Lucky for you that I decided to turn up to help today, he says. I knew something like this would happen. This is why I had to give you my number. You're totally a danger to yourself. And then he appears, strolling casually past, phone pressed to his ear, not even aware that I'm only meters from him. I pound my hand repeatedly on the door window. Michael reverses several steps, uncharacteristically frowning. And peers at me. Then he grins, hangs up the phone, and waves wildly. Tori! Hey! Get me out, I say, laying my hand flat against the window. Are you sure it's locked?
No, I just forgot how to open a door.
I'll open it if you do something for me first. I bash the window several more times, as if he is some kind of animal, and I'm trying to scare him into action.
I quite literally do not have time for this.
Just one thing. I stare at him, hoping that it's strong enough to paralyze, if not kill him. He shrugs at me, though I don't know why. Smile. I slowly shake my head.
What is wrong with you? You don't understand what just happened to me.
If you prove to me you have the capacity to smile, I will believe that you are a human being and I will let you out.
He's completely serious.
My hand drops. I could not be smiling any less than I am now.
I hate you.
No, you don't.
Just let me out.
You asked me if I was a real person. He adjusts his glasses and his voice suddenly gets quiet. It's unnerving. Did it occur to you that I might not believe that you are a real person? So I smile. I don't know what it ends up looking like, but I move my cheek muscles and wrench the sides of my mouth up a little to make the crescent moon shape with my lips. Michael's reaction reveals that he had not, in fact, expected me to do it. I immediately regret giving in. His eyes stretch wide and his own smile drops and is gone. Holy crap, he says. That was actually really difficult for you. I let it go.
All right, we're both real, turn the lock.
And he does. We look at each other, and then I start to barge past him, but he steps in front of me, placing his hand on each side of the door frame.
What?
I'm going to have a breakdown.
This guy, Jesus Christ.
Why were you locked in an IT room? He asks. His eyes are so wide.
Is he concerned?
What happened in there? I glance to one side. I don't really want to look him in the eyes. Solitaire hacked the whiteboard, sent round a message to the prefects, and a video. Michael gasps like a cartoon. He removes his hands from the doorframe and places them both on my shoulders. I cower backward.
What did it say?
He asks, half amazed, half terrified.
What was the video?
In any other situation, I don't think I'd bother telling him. I mean, who cares, right?
Go look for yourself, I mutter.
I step back into the room and he skips around me toward the projector computer.
It's just something stupid,
I say, collapsing onto a swivel chair next to him.
And actually, you won't be able to do anything on that computer anyway.
But Michael is moving the mouse totally normally, flying the cursor back toward the Word document. He reads the entire message aloud.
Patience kills,
he mumbles.
Patience kills.
He then insists that we watch the video, which I agree to, mostly because I thought it was so lovely the first time. When it finishes, he says,
You thought that was just something stupid?
There's a pause. I can play the violin, I say.
Seriously?
Yeah. Well, not anymore. I stopped practicing a few years ago. Michael gives me this weird look, but then it's gone, and suddenly he's impressed.
You know, I bet they've hacked the whole school. That is absolutely outstanding.
Before I have a chance to disagree, he's opened up Internet Explorer and typed in solitaire.co.uk. The Solitaire blog pops up with a new text post at the top of the screen. Michael breathes so loudly I can hear him. 0030, 11th of January. Solitarians. The first solitaire meetup will take place on Saturday, 22nd of January, 8 p.m. onward, at the third house from the river bridge. All are welcome. When I look up at Michael, he is carefully taking a photograph of the post on his phone.
"This is gold," he says. "This is the best discovery I've made all day."
"It's only 7:30, I say. "It's important to make lots of discoveries every day." He stands back up. "That's what makes one day different from the next." If that statement is true, that explains a lot of things about my life.
"You looked so freaked out."
Michael sits down in the chair next to me and leans forward so that his face is parallel to my own.
"We made progress. Be excited."
"Progress? Progress with what?" He frowns.
"The solitaire investigation. We have made a significant leap forward here."
"Oh. You still don't sound excited."
"Can you imagine me being excited about anything?"
"Yes, I can, actually." I glare at his stupid, smug face. He starts tapping his fingers together.
"Anyway," he says, "we're going to their meetup."
I hadn't thought about that.
We are?
Yeah. It's next Saturday. I will drag you there if I have to.
"Why do you want to go? What is the point of this?"
He opens his eyes very wide.
"You aren't curious."
"He's delusional. He's more delusional than I am, and that's saying something."
Look, I say, "it is perfectly okay to hang out, like, if you want, but I don't care about solitaire, and to be totally honest, I don't really want to get involved, so, yeah, sorry."
He gives me a long look. "Interesting." I say nothing.
"They locked you in this room," he says, "and you still don't care. Why not consider it this way? They're the evil criminal organization and you're Sherlock Holmes. I'll be John Watson, but we've got to be the Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman Sherlock and Watson, because the BBC Sherlock is infinitely greater than all other adaptations."
I stare at him.
"It's the only adaptation that gets the bromance right."
"You're a fangirl," I whisper with mock horror.
Another pause, in which I abruptly wonder whether the Sherlock fandom is right and there really is sexual tension between Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. Eventually, we get up and leave. Or at least I do, and he follows, shutting the door behind him. For the first time, I realize that he is wearing just his shirt, tie, and trousers, no jumper or blazer.
"Aren't you cold?" I say.
He blinks at me. His glasses are enormous. His hair is so neat that it's almost made of stone.
"Why, are you?"
We head down the corridor, and after we've almost reached the end, I notice that Michael is no longer at my heels. I turn around. He has stopped directly in front of C-16 and opened it up. He frowns. It looks a little odd on his face.
"What?"
I ask. It takes him longer than it should to answer.
"Nothing," he says. "I thought there would be something here, but there's nothing."
Before I have a chance to question what the bloody hell he's talking about, someone behind me cries, "Tori!" I spin back around. Zelda is striding toward me with an expression on her face that will one day provide her with premature wrinkles.
"Tori, have you found anything?"
I think about whether to lie or not.
"No, we didn't find anything. Sorry."
"What do you mean, we?"
I turn back to Michael, or the space where Michael had been standing. But he's not there. Only then do I wonder what it really was that made him decide to turn up at school at 7:30 in the morning.
Chapter 10.
I spend the rest of the day thinking about what Michael said in C-16. Later on, I go back to have a look myself. But he was right. There's nothing. I guess getting locked in an IT room kind of shook me up. I don't tell Becky about any of the solitaire stuff. She's very busy spreading the word about her fancy dress birthday party, which is to be held on Friday, and I don't think she'd really care much. At lunch, Lucas finds me in the common room. I'm trying to read another chapter of Pride and Prejudice, but I think I'm just going to watch the film version, because this book is brain-melting. The common room is pretty empty. Everyone's probably walked up to McDonald's, because the food in our school is prison food. All right, Lucas says, seating himself at my table. I hate that. All right. I mean, is it a greeting or a question? Do you respond with, good, thanks, or hello? Not too bad, I say, sitting up a little. You?
I'm good, thanks.
I can physically feel him searching for something to say. After a stupidly long pause, he reaches toward me and taps the book I'm holding.
You hate reading, right? Why don't you just watch the film?
I blink at him and say, I don't know. After another stupidly long pause, he asks,
you going to Becky's on Friday?
What a dumb question.
Yeah, I say. I assume you are too.
Yes, yeah. Who are you dressing up as?
I don't know yet.
He nods as if what I've said actually means something.
Well, I'm sure you'll look good, he says, and then quickly adds, because, you know, when we were little, you were really into dressing up and stuff.
I don't remember ever dressing up as anything except a Jedi. I shrug at Lucas. I'll find something.
And then he just turns bright red, like he does, and sits there watching me attempt to read for some time. So awkward. Jesus Christ.
Eventually, he gets out his phone and starts texting, and when he goes off to talk to Evelyn, I get to wondering why he is always hovering around like some ghost who doesn't want to be forgotten. I don't want to talk to him, really. I mean, I thought that it'd be nice to try and rekindle this friendship, but it's too hard. I don't want to talk to anyone. Of course, I tell Charlie everything when we get home. He does not know what to say about Solitaire's mysterious message. Instead, he tells me I should stop talking to Michael so much. I am not sure what I think about that. At dinner, Dad asks, how'd it go this morning? We didn't find anything, I say. Another lie. I must be borderline pathological. Dad starts talking about another book that he's going to lend me. He's always lending me books. Dad went to university when he was 32 and did an English literature degree. He now works in IT. Nevertheless, he is always hoping that I'll turn out to be some magnanimous thinker who has read a lot of Chekhov and James Joyce. Coming out as a book hater to my dad is comparable to coming out as gay to homophobic parents. I've never been able to tell him, and he's lent me so many books now that it's just too late to repair the damage. Anyway, this time it's Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. I nod and smile and try to sound a little interested, but it probably isn't at all convincing. Charlie quickly changes the subject by telling us about some film he and Nick watched over the weekend. An Education, which from Charlie's description sounds like a total mockery and patronization of teenage girls worldwide. Oliver then tells us about his new toy tractor and why it is so much more majestic than all his other toy tractors. To Mum and Dad's delight, we finished dinner within 1 hour, which must be a new record.
Well done, Charlie. Great job, says Dad, slapping him on the back.
But Charlie just winces away from him.
Mum nods and smiles, which is about as expressive as she gets. It's like Charlie's won the Nobel Prize. He escapes the kitchen without saying a word and comes to watch The Big Bang Theory with me. It's not a very funny program, but I still seem to watch at least one episode every single day. Who would I be, I ask at some point, if I were any of the Big Bang Theory characters? Sheldon, says Charlie without hesitation, but, like, not as loud about your views. I turn my head toward him. Wow, I'm offended, Charlie snorts. He's the only reason this show is any good, Victoria. I think about this and then nod. That's probably true. Charlie lays still on the sofa, and I watch him for a minute. His eyes are sort of glazed, like he's not really watching the TV, and he's fiddling with his shirt sleeves. Charlie always wears long-sleeve shirts these days. Who would I be? He asks. I stroke my chin thoughtfully before declaring, Howard, definitely, because you're always chatting up the ladies. Charlie chucks a cushion at me from the sofa. I scream and cower in the corner before hurling a barrage of cushions back at him. Tonight I watch the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice and find it to be almost as dreadful as the book. The only tolerable character is Mr. Darcy. I don't see why Elizabeth finds him proud at the beginning, because it's quite clearly obvious that he's just shy. Any normal human being should be able to identify that as shyness and feel sorry for the poor guy, because he's dreadful at parties and social gatherings. It's not really his fault. It's just the way he is. I blog some more, and lie awake listening to the rain, and forget what the time is, and forget to change into my pyjamas. I add Metamorphosis to the pile of unread books. I put The Breakfast Club on, but I'm not really watching, so I skip to the best part, a part where they're all sitting in a circle, and they reveal those deep and personal things, and they cry and all that. I watch that scene 3 times, and then turn it off. I listen for the giant/demon, but it's more of a rumbling tonight, a deep growling rumble like a drum. In the swirly wallpaper of my room, stooped yellow figures creep back and forth, and back and forth, until I'm hypnotized. In my bed, someone has placed an enormous glass cage on top of me, and the air is slowly stewing sour. In my dreams, I'm running around in circles atop a cliff, but there's a boy in a red hat catching me every time I try to jump off. Chapter 11.
I'm not joking, Tori. This is an extremely serious decision.
I look Becky squarely in the eye.
Oh, I know. This could determine the whole future of human existence.
We are in her bedroom. It's 4:12 p.m, Friday. I'm cross-legged on her double bed. Everything in here is pink and black, and if this room were a person, it would be a Kardashian on a moderate income. There is a poster of Edward Cullen and Bella Swan on the wall. Every time I see it, I want to put it through a shredder.
No, seriously though, I'm not even joking.
She holds up the costumes again, one in each hand.
Tinkerbell or Hermione?
I stare at each. They're not very different, except one is green and one is grey. Tinkerbell, I say. Seeing as Becky maintains her coolness and hilarity by acting like an idiot, it would be an insult to the name of Hermione Granger and J.K. Rowling and all Potterheads to allow Becky to be the brightest witch of her age. She nods and chucks the Hermione outfit onto a steadily growing mountain of clothes.
That's what I thought. She starts changing. Who are you going as again?
I shrug, still thinking about Harry Potter. I wasn't going to dress up. I thought I could wear my invisibility cloak. Becky, in just her bra and knickers, puts her hands on her hips. I know I shouldn't feel awkward because I've been her best friend for over 5 years. I still do, though. Since when did nudity become so normal? Tori, you are dressing up. It's my fancy dress party and I say so. Fine. I think hard, weighing my options. I could go as Snow White. Becky pauses, as if waiting for the punchline. I frown.
What?
Nothing. I didn't say anything.
You don't think I could go as Snow White?
No, you could be Snow White, if you want. I look at my hands. All right. I'll think about it. I twirl my thumbs. I could make my hair all wavy.
She seems satisfied and puts on the tiny green dress with fairy wings.
Are you going to try and talk to people tonight? She asks. Is that an actual question or an order?
An order.
I make no promises.
Becky laughs and pats me on my cheek. I hate that.
Don't worry, I'll look after you. I always do, don't I? At home, I put on a white shirt and a black skater skirt I bought once for some job interview I never showed up to. Then I locate my favourite black jumper and black tights. My hair is just about long enough to style into tiny plaits, and I draw on more eyeliner than usual. Wednesday Addams. I was sort of kidding with Snow White, and I despise Disney anyway. I leave the house around 7. Nick, Charlie and Oliver are just sitting down to dinner. Mum and Dad are going to see a play and then stay at a hotel tonight. To be honest, it was Charlie and I who insisted that they stay overnight rather than take the 2-hour drive home. I guess they were kind of worried about not being there for Charlie. I almost decided to stay home and not go to Becky's party, but Charlie assured everyone that he would be fine, which I'm sure he will, because Nick's staying round this evening, and I'm not even going to be out for very long. It's a dark party. The lights are dimmed and teenagers are spilling out of the house. I pass the smokers and the social smokers who gather in rings outside. Smoking is so pointless. The only reason I can think of for smoking is if you want to die. I don't know. Maybe they all want to die. I recognise most people from school and from Truam. And there are year 11s through to year 13s here, and I know for a fact that Becky doesn't know them all personally. A selection of our lot is squeezed into the conservatory, along with a few other people that I don't know. Evelyn, scrunched into the corner of a sofa, spots me first.
Tori!
She waves, so I wander over. Eyeing me thoughtfully, she says,
Who are you?
Wednesday Addams, I say.
Who?
Have you seen the Addams family?
No.
I shuffle my feet. Oh. Her own outfit is rather spectacular. Straightened hair, put up in a classy bun, insect sunglasses and a 50s dress. You're Audrey Hepburn. Evelyn throws her arms up in the air.
Thank you! Someone at this party has some bloody culture.
Lucas is here too, sitting next to a girl and a boy who have basically merged into one being. He's wearing a beret and a rolled-sleeve stripy t-shirt with these skin-tight ankle-length black jeans, and he has an actual string of garlic bulbs hung around his neck. Somehow, he looks both very fashionable and very ridiculous. He waves shyly at me with his beer can.
Tori, bonjour.
I wave back and then practically run away. First I go to the kitchen. There are a lot of year 11s in here, mostly girls dressed as a variety of promiscuous Disney princesses, and three boys dressed as Superman. They're chatting excitedly about Solitaire's pranks, apparently finding them hilarious. One girl even claims she took part in them. Everyone seems to be talking about the Solitaire meetup blog post, the one that Michael and I found after he broke me out of that IT classroom. Apparently, the entire town is planning to attend. I find myself standing next to a lonely-looking girl, possibly a year 11, but I'm not too sure, who is dressed as a very accurate David Tennant's Doctor Who. I immediately feel a kind of connection with her, because she looks so alone. She looks at me, and as it's too late to pretend I haven't been staring, I say, "Your costume is, really good." "Thank you," she says, and I nod and walk off. Ignoring the beers and WKDs and Bacardi breezers, I raid Becky's fridge for some diet lemonade. With my plastic cup in hand, I amble into the garden. It's a truly magnificent garden, slightly sloped with islands of rainbow flowers and a pond at the bottom, enclosed by clusters of bare willow trees. Groups are huddled all over the wooden decking and the grass, even though it's about 0 degrees Celsius. Somehow, Becky has got her hands on an actual floodlight. It's as bright as the sun, and the groups of teenagers spill swaying shadows over the grass. I spot Becky / Tinkerbell with a different group of year 12s. I go up to her. "Hey," I say, sliding into the circle.
"Tori!"
She's got a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream in her hand with one of those curly plastic straws in it.
"Dude, guess what? I've got something so amazing to tell you. It's just so amazing. You're going to die. It's so, so, so amazing. You are going to die."
I smile at her, even though she's shaking me by the shoulders and spilling Bailey's on me.
"You are going to die."
"Yes, yes, I'm going to die. You know Ben Hope?" "Yes, I know Ben Hope, and I also know exactly what she's about to say."
"Ben Hope asked me out," she splutters.
"Oh," I say, "my God."
"I know, I, like, did not expect a thing. We were chatting earlier and he admitted he liked me. Oh my God, he was so cute and awkward."
And then she talks for quite a while about Ben Hope while sipping on her Baileys. And I'm smiling and nodding and definitely feeling really pleased for her. After a while, Becky starts repeating the whole story to some girl dressed as Minnie Mouse. And I feel myself getting a bit bored. So I check my blog on my phone. There is a little one symbol signifying I have a message. Anonymous. Thought for the day. Why do cars always part for ambulances? I read the message several times. It could be from anyone, I guess. Though no one I know in real life knows about my blog. Stupid anons. Why do cars always part for ambulances?
Because the world is not filled with arseholes, that's why.
Because the world is not filled with arseholes. As soon as I make that conclusion in my mind, Lucas finds me. He is a little bit drunk.
"I can't work out who you are," he says, always so embarrassed.
"I'm Wednesday Adams."
"Ah. So cute, so cute."
He nods knowingly, but I can tell that he has no idea who Wednesday Adams is. I look past him, out into the floodlit garden. All the people are just blurred darkness. I feel a bit sick, and this diet lemonade is giving me a nasty taste in my mouth. I want to go and pour it down the sink, but I think I'll feel even more lost if I don't have something to hold on to.
"Tori?"
I look at him. The garlic was a bad move.
It doesn't smell great.
I asked if you were all right. You look like you're having a midlife crisis.
It's not a midlife crisis. It's just a life crisis.
Pardon? I can't hear you.
I'm fine, just bored. He smiles at me like I'm joking, but I'm not joking. All parties are boring. You can go and talk to other people, you know, I say. I really don't have anything interesting to say.
You always have interesting things to say, he says. You just don't say them.
I lie and say I need another drink, even though my cup is more than half full, and I feel really sick. I get out of the garden. I am out of breath and so angry for no reason. I barge through the crowds of stupid drunk teenagers and lock myself in the downstairs bathroom. Someone's been sick in here. I can smell it. I look at myself in the mirror. My eyeliner has smudged, so I sort it out. Then I tear up and ruin it again and try not to start crying. I wash my hands 3 times and take the plaits out of my hair because they look idiotic. Someone's banging on the door of the bathroom. I've been in here for ages just staring at myself in the mirror, watching my eyes tear up and dry and tear up and dry. I open the door ready to punch them in the face and find myself directly opposite Michael Goddamn Holden. Oh, thank Christ. He races inside and without bothering to let me leave or shut the door, he lifts the toilet seat and starts to pee. Thank Christ. I thought I was going to have to piss in the flower bed for Christ's sake.
All right, just pee with a lady present, I say.
He waves his hand casually. I get out of there. As I exit through the front door, Michael catches me up. He is dressed as Sherlock Holmes, even the hat.
Where are you going? He asks.
I shrug. It's too hot in there. It's too cold out here.
Since when did you acquire a body temperature?
Will you ever be able to talk to me without making a sarcastic comment? I turn and start walking farther away, but he's still in pursuit.
Why are you following me?
Because I don't know anyone else here.
Don't you have any year 13 friends?
I stop on the pavement outside Becky's drive.
I think I'm going home, I say. Why? He asks. Becky's your friend. It's her birthday.
She won't mind, I say. She won't notice.
What are you going to do at home? He asks.
Blog. Sleep. Blog.
Nothing. Why don't we crash in a room upstairs and watch a film?
Coming from any other person's mouth, it would sound like he is asking me to go into a room and have sex with him. But because it is Michael who says this, I know that he is being completely serious. I notice that the diet lemonade in my cup has gone. I can't remember when I drank it. I want to go home, but at the same time, I don't want to, because I know I won't sleep. I'll just lie there in my room. Michael's hat looks really stupid. He probably borrowed that tweed jacket from a dead body.
Fine, I say.
Chapter 12. There is a line that you cross when making relationships with people. Crossing this line occurs when you transfer from knowing someone to knowing about someone. And Michael and I cross that line at Becky's 17th birthday party. We go upstairs into Becky's room. He, of course, begins to investigate, while I drop and roll onto the bed. He passes the poster of Edward Cullen and Bella No Expression Swan, raising a skeptical eyebrow at it. He trails along the shelf of dancing show photographs and medals and the shelf of preteen books that have lain untouched for years. And he steps over the piles and piles of crumpled dresses and shorts and T-shirts and knickers and bras, and school books and bags and miscellaneous pieces of paper, until, finally, he opens a wardrobe, bypasses the shelves of folded-up clothes, and locates a small row of DVDs. He pulls out Moulin Rouge, but, seeing the look on my face, quickly replaces it. A similar thing happens when he retrieves It's a Boy-Girl Thing. After a moment more, he gasps and grabs a third DVD, leaps across the room to the flat screen, and switches it on. "We're watching Beauty and the Beast," he says. "No, we are not," I say. "I think you will find that we are," he says. "Please," I say. "No, what about The Matrix? Lost in Translation? Lord of the Rings?" I don't know why I'm saying this. Becky owns none of these films. "I'm doing this for your own good." He inserts the DVD. "I believe that your psychological development has substantially suffered due to lack of Disney charm." I don't bother asking what he's talking about. He clambers onto the bed next to me and props himself up on the headboard with a pillow. The Disney logo appears on screen. Already I can feel my eyes bleeding. "Have you ever even watched a Disney film?" he asks. Yeah. "Why do you hate Disney?"
"I don't hate Disney."
"Then why don't you want to watch Beauty and the Beast?" I turn my head. He's not watching the film, even though it started. "I don't like films that are fake," I say, "where the characters and the story are really perfect. Things don't happen like that in real life." He smiles, but it's a sad smile. "Isn't that the point of films?" I wonder why I'm here. I wonder why he's here. The pathetic dubstep beat downstairs is the only thing I can hear. There are some cartoons on the screen, but really, they're just moving shapes. He starts talking to me. "Did you know," he says, "that in the original story, Belle has two sisters? But in this film, she's an only child. I wonder why." It's not that fun being an only child. "Are you an only child?" "Yep." This is mildly interesting. "I've got two brothers," I say. "Are they like you?" "No, they're really not." The beauty is being courted by a heavily muscled man. He is not attractive. But I sympathize with his dislike of literature. "She really likes to read," I say, shaking my head at the girl in blue. "That's got to be unhealthy." "Don't you do English Lit A-level?" "Yes, because I can bullshit my way through it, but I don't approve of it. I hate books." "I probably should have done English. I would have been good at it."
"Why didn't you?"
He looks at me and smiles. "I think it's better to just read and not study books." The beauty has sacrificed her freedom to save her father. It's very sentimental, and now she's crying about it.
"Tell me something interesting about you," says Michael.
I think for a moment.
"Did you know that I was born on the day that Kurt Cobain killed himself?"
"Actually, yes. He was only 27, the poor guy. 27. Maybe we'll die when we're 27.
"There's nothing romantic about death. I hate when people use Kurt Cobain's suicide as an excuse to worship him for being such a tormented soul."
Michael pauses and stares at me before saying, "Yeah, I guess so." Beauty has gone on a hunger strike. That is, until the cutlery and crockery of the house put on a singing and dancing performance for her. Now she's being chased by wolves. I am struggling to keep up with the plot line.
"Tell me something interesting about you," I say.
He says,
I'm, like, ridiculously unintelligent. I frown at him. This is obviously untrue.
He reads my mind.
Seriously, I haven't got above a C grade in any subject since year 8.
What? Why?
I just...
It seems almost impossible for someone like Michael to be unintelligent. People like Michael, crazy people who get stuff done, they're always smart. Always. When it comes to the exams, I generally don't write what they want me to write. I'm not very good at, sorting out all the stuff in my head. Like, I took biology A-level, and I completely understood what polypeptide synthesis was, but I couldn't write it down. I'm not dyslexic or anything, I just don't know what the examiners want to hear. I don't know whether I just forget things, or maybe I don't know how I'm supposed to explain it. I just don't know, and it's fucking horrible. Throughout this, he makes swirly gestures with his hands. I imagine all the pieces of information flying around in strands inside his brain, unable to form themselves into comprehensible words. It seems to make sense. He's crazy. Maybe not in a bad way, but he's definitely crazy. It's so unfair, he continues. School literally doesn't care about you unless you're good at writing stuff down, or you're good at memorizing, or you can solve bloody maths equations. What about the other important things in life, like being a decent human being? I hate school, I say. You hate everything. It's funny, because it's true. He turns to me again. We look at each other. On screen, a petal falls from the rose, which I'm pretty sure is symbolic of something. Your eyes are different colours, I say. Did I not tell you that I'm a magical anime girl? Seriously, why though? My blue eye conceals the power of my past life, and I use it to summon my guardian angels to assist me in my plight against the forces of darkness. Are you drunk? I'm a poet. Well, control yourself, Lord Tennyson. He grins. The stream will cease to flow. He's quoting a poem, obviously, but one I've never heard. The wind will cease to blow, the clouds will cease to fleet, the heart will cease to beat, for all things must die. I chuck a pillow at him. He leans over to avoid it, but my aim is spectacular. All right, he laughs. It's not as romantic as it looks. Someone threw a rock at my eye when I was 2, so basically I'm pretty much half blind. It's actually very annoying. On screen, they're dancing. It's a little odd. An old woman is singing. I find myself singing along. Apparently, I've heard this song before. Michael joins me. We sing alternate lines. And then we are silent for a long time, watching the colours on the screen. I don't know how long the silence lasts, but at some point I hear Michael sniff, and I see him move his hand up to his face. When I look around, I see that he is crying, actually crying. I am momentarily confused. I study the screen. The beast has just died, and the beauty is holding him, crying herself, and, oh, wait, a tear falls onto his fur, and then all kinds of trippy magic happens, and, yep, there you go, he has miraculously returned from the dead. Oh, and he's become handsome as well, isn't that fantastic? This is the kind of crap that I hate. Unrealistic, sentimental, crap. But Michael is crying. I don't really know what to do. He's got one hand on his face, and his eyes and nose are scrunched up. It's like he's trying to hold the tears inside. I decide to pat his other hand, which is resting on the bed. I hope this comes across as comforting, not sarcastic.
I think it turns out okay, because he grabs my hand in return and squeezes it with extreme force. The film ends shortly after that. He turns it off with the remote, and we sit in silence, looking at the black screen. I knew your brother, Michael says, after a very long time. Charlie? From Truam. I turn my head, not really finding anything to say. Michael continues. I never spoke to him. He always seemed kind of quiet. But everyone loved him, which is pretty rare at an all-boys school. He was different. It's then that I decide to tell him. I don't know why this happens, but I get this urge. My brain gives up. I can't hold on to it. I tell him about Charlie. Everything. About when he started collecting things. And about when he stopped eating. And about when he started hurting himself. To be honest, it's not even that big of a deal anymore. He's been to the hospital, he's better now. And he's got Nick. I mean, he's still recovering, but he's fine. It's fine. I don't know when I fall asleep, but I do. Not fully asleep. I stop being able to tell whether I'm awake or whether I'm dreaming. It's probably weird to fall asleep in this sort of situation. But I'm starting to not really care about stuff like that anymore. What surprises me the most is how suddenly it happens. Normally, it takes forever. Normally, when I'm trying to sleep, I do all these silly things, like I roll over and imagine that I'm sleeping next to someone, and I reach out and caress their hair. Or I clasp my hands together, and after a little while, I start thinking it's somebody else's hand I'm holding, not my own. I swear to God there's something wrong with me. There really is. But this time, I feel myself roll slightly over, so I'm resting on his chest, under his arm. He smells vaguely of bonfires. At some point, I think someone opens the door and sees us lying there half asleep together. Whoever it is looks at us for a moment before quietly shutting the door again. The shouting downstairs begins to ease, even though the music is still pumping. I half listen for any demonic creatures outside the window. But it's a silent night. Nothing traps me. It's nice. I feel the air in the room. And it's like there is none. My phone rings. 1:39 a.m. Home calling. Hello?
Tori, are you coming home yet? Oliver, why aren't you in bed? I was watching Doctor Who.
You didn't watch the Weeping Angels episode, did you? Ollie, are you all right? Why did you call me? Oliver, are you there? Something's wrong with Charlie. My face must then do something very unusual because Michael gives me this look. This funny, terrified look. What has happened? What's happened, Oliver? What's Charlie done? Where is he?
I can't get in the kitchen. Charlie shut the door and I can't open it. I can hear him. When are you coming home, Tori?
I'm coming home right now. I hang up. Michael is awake. I am cross-legged in the middle of the bed. He is cross-legged opposite me. Shit, I say. Shit, 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 fucking fuck. Michael doesn't even ask. He just says, I'll take you home. We're running. Out the door and down the stairs and through the people. Some still partying, some piled on the floor, some making out, some crying. I'm almost at the front door when Becky catches me. She is fucked.
I'm fucked,
She grabs my arm really tight.
I'm going now, Becky.
You're so cute, Tori. I miss you. I love you so much. You are so beautiful and cute.